Hey, welcome in to All Ball. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is the All Basketball Podcast and the Herd Podcast Network. My guest this week is my longtime friend and college and radio rival, Eric Chenoweth. Of course, EC was the center at Kansas for a couple years, and I was at Oklahoma State, second-round pick of the New York Knicks. He's a former McDonald's All-American, and he now sells a various allotment of insurance policies to both schools and athletes as they get ready to either come back and play in college or to prepare for the NBA NFL draft. Anyway, EC will join us upcoming. Let's talk about the story that won't go away. Right? It's crazy because we're less than a week away from the NBA season beginning. Clippers and Lakers at Staples Center. That's the marquee matchup on opening night. Right, the new Grand Theft Auto font on the front of the Clippers jersey. I'm in. I can't wait to see this kind of burgeoning rivalry in the City of Angels. That said, what a disaster week for LeBron James. I mean, not good. Not good. And I do think that some of the things that he said are true. Many of the things he said are true. Like, I don't know if Daryl Morey is truly educated on Hong Kong, on what... There's a difference between Hong Kong and then the practices of the Chinese government. There is. I don't know why he said people could be spiritually harmed. The idea they could be physically harmed. Financially harmed obviously perked everybody's ears. And then the idea that LeBron had to then have a statement on Instagram, not once but twice. So he had two statements on Instagram and then... He came out and made another statement at practice and another statement at practice, and then he said, I'm not going to talk about it anymore. Because they all kind of went over the same. He's put himself in a couple of different corners. LeBron and many of his cohorts in the NBA who look up to him have criticized politically the right wing. Not just the president, but also people who don't believe what he believes. And that's fine. Like he said, he does have freedom of speech, not free of ramification. The problem is that when he takes the stance that he's perceived to be taking on China, well, you spent, I don't know, the last 4 or 5 years pissing off the right, and now you're taking a crap on the left. So that's a hard one. And then here's kind of, to me, the biggest hypocrisy is not getting mad because it's hurting you in your wallet and the idea that he is, in fact, selling out. It's because he's not wrong. You don't have to comment on everything. Like, even the idea of being more than an athlete, like, you don't have to comment on everything. Like, even in our newscast, how many times do we see there's a tragic accident? Only five Americans perished. No Americans perished. Like, oh, the accident's not that big a deal because no Americans perished, right? So we won't comment on it. We won't send relief effort forward unless it somehow affects us. He's not wrong there. And he's not wrong that many are uneducated on what's going on in Hong Kong. But it hasn't stopped him from speaking out on things in the past that he might not be all that educated on, right? I mean, NCAA athletes, he didn't play in college. What does he know about the college experience? What does he know about the value of, you know, it goes counter to his perceived and preached belief of the value of education for his I Promise school. I think, though, that the biggest issue is that LeBron James has been a leader to the idea of, if you're not getting what you want, don't play. Leave, go to somewhere else, right? Whether it's in his career. NFL players, Jalen Ramsey, I'm not going to play, end up getting traded. Like, that's great. You're in China. You knew about the controversy. Don't play. You don't have to play. Why not? You're LeBron James. So, look, the LeBron thing, I don't know. You know, he's done an amazing job his entire life. Or public life, which is like his junior year in high school on, of seemingly saying and doing most of the right things. And, of course, the criticism of when he first left Cleveland was wrong. You know, I don't know why he needed to donate $2 million to a boys club in Greenwich, Connecticut. You know, could have done the same to Akron back then, but now we're just kind of trying to find flaws with the supermodel. You know, there's been no talk of drugs, affairs with women. You know, it's been basketball stuff, not liking coaches, some getting some of them fired, not loving playing in certain organizations and moving on, wanting better players than he had last year with the Lakers. That's basketball, professional stuff, not personal stuff. I'm not saying the guy is flawless, but the PR of LeBron has for the most part been flawless. But here's, I think, what happens. Like, let's hit the nail on the head. What happens when you become so big and you keep your circle so small and people come in and all they want to do is kiss the ring? Nobody tells you you're wrong anymore. And they had a week. They had an entire week to figure out, man, what am I going to say about this China thing? Because look, anybody with a brain understands we're tapped out in the United States, right? Like Facebook, Google, Apple, Yahoo, you know, those are the companies, I'm forgetting somebody, those are the companies that have all the cash. Everybody else kind of tapped out. And you're looking for markets where there's growth. Turkey's one. The other one is China. China has the people. China has the growth. China was suppressed for years because of how they were old school communist. Now they're like new school capitalist slash communist. And everybody's trying to get in on China. They just are. That's why baseball wants to play there. Football wants to play there. Basketball already is playing there. Like, that's, it's no secret. It's about the money. It's about the people. It's about the financial resources to have more people have more money. But boy, for a guy who has done so many things the right way to appear to be about the bottom line. And I don't even think it's about his bottom line. Like, I don't think he's that ticked that his appearances were canceled. But he's mad Kyle Kuzma lost $1 million. But if you lose $1 million for the right reason, right? And by the way, you might lose $1 million now. You might make two on the back end of it if you do things the right way. Hey, we're not gonna play. Where was the stance? Where's the stance of, unless there's some improvement to human rights, we're not gonna play? If you're so bothered by one tweet, then maybe you shouldn't have us play basketball in your country, because this is how we feel. And I do, like, I feel for the idea that it's a different country. It's a completely different government, completely different ideology than the one we grew up in or the one we grew up aiming to have America be. But if you're going to defend it, especially considering who you've aligned yourself politically with, this is what you're going to be met with. LeBron James is an athlete, immensely talented one, but he's not more than an athlete, unless you consider being a capitalist more than an athlete. Let me just give you this kind of real quick preview college basketball thought. As we creep closer and closer to when we believe that high school players will be allowed to come out straight to the pros, let's appreciate the superstar freshmen that are going to be playing college basketball, like Cole Anthony. Now, I saw Cole Anthony, it's Greg Anthony's son. I saw him play several times over the past 3 years. And he's got a little asshole in him, right? And I mean that in an endearing quality. Like, he's so tough and so kind of mean and so competitive that I feel like, and I know there are people who will tell you, he's not great to play with. He can be a little selfish. He can be a little temperamental. Like, yeah, I think Coach Williams will handle that. I just do. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he doesn't win the Bob Cousy Award. Wouldn't be surprised at all if he becomes a National Player of the Year candidate. He's that talented. Carolina's pretty good as well. So, but they lose so much, losing, you know, Cam Johnson and you know, that kind of dynamic combination of two, you know, old big guys that can really shoot the basketball, and Luke May, who I saw just got cut. But the teams that will win, for the most part, are going to be the older teams, the way it is, although there's been this massive purge and massive turnover in college basketball, so many guys going to pros. But the things that we're going to miss, these top five, top 10 high school Americans because they'll all go pro. I think ultimately, if that happens, it'll work out. I think ultimately it'll work out where too many guys go pro the first couple of years, and then eventually they figure out, hey, the G League is not a great place. If you're not going to be a lottery pick, if you're not going to be on an NBA team, go to college for a couple of years. But I do think for several years we're going to lose a lot of those high school Americans. I'm excited about Cole Anthony. He's a different type of cat in terms of not just pedigree, toughness, tenacity. His shooting continues to improve. He defends. He's got size. He's got athleticism. He's really, really good. So you'll enjoy watching him, but let's enjoy watching these talented freshmen because we won't see as many have as profound an impact in the years to come. All right, let's welcome in my first guest. My guest, he's Eric Chenoweth, former star at the University of Kansas, former second-round draft pick of the New York Knicks.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Let's catch up with the legend himself. He was a McDonald's All-American in 1997 out of Villa Park High School. Who was in the McDonald's All-American game in 97?
Wow, we had some guys, Elton Brand, Lamar Odom, Brendan Haywood, Chris Burgess, Ron Artest. We had Baron Davis, Collins Twins.
That's a lot of big. West Coast big dudes, right?
Yeah. It was like I think it was kind of the last crop of real, you know, big guys. There was obviously the Tyson Chandler and a couple guys after that, but since then it's kind of been a lot of wings and guards coming out of Southern California.
You guys got beat badly. You had Britton Johnson, Jason Collins, yeah. Jaron Collins, you, Burgess, who did my pod earlier, and Marcus Griffin, and Ryan Humphrey, my man Hump, all on the same team, and you guys lost. Now, the other team had other bigs, Lamar Odom, Melvin Eli, and Brendan Haywood, Marcus Fizer. What do you remember about the game?
Bad coaching, obviously, you know, I mean, it's never our fault. I was kind of like starstruck the whole time. I was just so honored to be there, to be named McDonald's All-American and then to actually get there and, you know, have a live game on CBS and, you know, get to play with my future teammate, Kenny Gregory. It was really, I just had to pinch myself the whole time. It was such a great experience. But the game was kind of a blur because it just went so fast and everything was so intense. Now the game is like a, you know, throw it up all-star game. But back then we actually got after it and, you know, played hard.
Why did you pick Kansas?
Because you wanted to go there really badly and coach didn't want to recruit you. So I thought I'd one up you and go there instead.
That is so fucked up. I wanted you to point out. I wanted to go to Duke, but they had taken Wojo the year before. I did always love Kansas and the way in which they played, and they took Robertson early. Ryan Robertson early, and you know he was local, uh-huh. And he was a McDonald's All-American my senior year, which I'll never get. Anyway, but he didn't. But no, but seriously, why Kansas?
I mean, obviously you've played a game there. I mean, once you step foot on that arena, all the history and the mystique to have a chance to play there, you know, it was beyond my furthest dreams. I remember when I was a kid, I used to do yard work with my dad, and we'd listen to games as we did work at the house. And I remember listening to like the '88 championship game over a radio with my dad, and like idolizing Danny Manning. And then he went to the Clippers, and I kind of got to know him through some friends, and it was always Kansas and everybody else for me. And then, I mean, really, honestly, I remember our Sunday night workouts at Tustin High School when we were in high school. And I remember one day you came in and you were like, I don't know, you were eating something and you were like, you know, hey, in between bites, you're like, oh, you're going to Kansas, fall down, 16,300. And I was like, it's really weird, but I think at that moment I kind of like conceptualized it like, you know what, I think that is the right spot for me. And then I committed early as well, too. I committed on August 1st, which was Coach's birthday after the recruiting period, and I wanted to have a fun senior year, not deal with all the recruiting and stress and who's going where. I knew where I wanted to go, and I went there, and, I mean, had great experience, won a lot of games, and you know, I still have really, really
wait. So
great
did you take
a, to the university?
Did you take a visit there before you committed?
I took unofficial. So I did all unofficials my
That's
junior year.
Right.
So I visited.
Yeah, you went to Notre Dame.
I visited Notre Dame.
Yeah,
I saw you. Saw Coach McLeod. I went to Indiana, Kansas. Obviously, we did Duke. I did Utah. I went to Majerus' big man camp, so I went there.
You hit all the big white guy spots. That's what you did.
Duke, well,
because remember, like, Duke had,
because
Duke had, like, Taman Domzowski's big, you know, all those big guys, Mark Akers and Leitner, right? And then, you know, Indiana always had big white guys, and Notre Dame, big white guys. Like, do you have a big white guy? Sure, I'll come visit your campus. That was basically your recruiting philosophy.
You said it. But, luckily my dad could afford to take us on his unofficial trips. Because, like I said, I really wanted to have a carefree, fun senior year. I didn't want to be missing football games on Fridays. I didn't want to be traveling everywhere. I wanted to just get it done with and then, you know, have my senior year to myself. So, the unofficial trips aren't as great as official trips, obviously. I did take an official trip to Kansas, but, I'm glad I got it done early.
Okay, so you show up at Kansas in the fall of 1997. That team had Paul Pierce and Rafe LaFrance. What do you remember? Mm-hmm. What was your first impressions of being on campus, playing pickup ball, what the whole experience was like?
I just remember the level of intensity, the step up from high school to college I can't even think a word to express it. I mean, it was just so much more intense, so much more physical. Coming in, obviously, as a McDonald's All-American, guys are going to go at you to see what you got and really challenge you. So I remember Rafe like going right at me right away day one and just kind of letting me know like, hey, this is how it's going to be. This is the level we play at. Especially, you know, even TJ Pugh, I'm sure you remember him, who's just a really intense player and really good defender. And so just day one was like, okay, it's on. And then I just remember being in awe of how good Paul was. I mean, I played against Paul in high school. Obviously, we did, and we knew him, and I knew how special he was. But he had, you know, improved his body, and he gotten stronger, and extended his range. And I just remember he would absolutely dominate every single day and pick up, And then once we did our conditioning tests and all that stuff, it just, you didn't have any time to get bored or homesick because you were so busy just in the grind of everything that started literally on day one.
When during this process did you fall in love with Dave Matthews Band?
I always liked Dave, even when I was in like high school. I mean, all of my buddies, we used to, go see him in concerts and stuff. And then, it's unfortunate because that story kind of took a life of its own. It's funny, our SID, Dean Buchan, who I'm still friends with, like every time he sees me, he cringes because he feels horrible about that story, just taking off and getting out of control. Because it was funny, what did you do on your summer vacation? It's like, well, woke up, go to lift weights, and then go play pickup, and then go to the beach, and I saw Dave Matthews Band, and it was like, oh, you saw Dave, and I'm like, yeah, I'm a big fan. They had two shows in Southern California, and then I went there with my buddies, and then we road tripped it up, to see him in the Bay. So I saw him up there, and then they were in Kansas when I was in Kansas. So I saw him four times last year, and then all of a sudden it turned into, oh, Eric's not focused. He's the next Bill Walton. Dave had, just traveling with the band. He's a groupie. I saw him on the stage. It turned into this complete, out of control story. And it coincided with me having a really good sophomore year and then going to my junior year and struggling and then having two really, really good players in Nick Holzman and Drew Gooden coming in. The minutes get, shared. And then all of a sudden, I don't love basketball and it's, Eric sucks and the whole deal. So it really spiraled out of control quickly. And, we've all had, public struggles. And so, and it was funny. I just saw Mark Sanchez talking about it the other day on sports about losing your starting position and how painful that is. And I remember, it was really, really hard, losing my starting spot. And then, obviously it was happy for Nick and Drew for succeeding, but I couldn't even listen to Dave Matthews Band for a while because people kept asking me about it. I'm like, dude, it's just a band I like to see in the summer with my buddies. It's not like I'm loading up a Winnebago and traveling all over the country. So, it's funny, like to this day, like I still like their music and, I still go see them when they're in town and stuff, but, that story, just took a life of its own.
Okay. So let's go back to 97. Cause you and Kenny Gregory were the two freshmen that played a bunch. You had another guy. People forget you guys had Lester Earl, who was like as highly touted a high school player as there ever was. Right, went to LSU and he just freak athlete, but just no real position. But you guys had this unbelievable in terms of name talent, right? Like to have Paul and Rafe, two basically NBA All Stars, top five picks. BT Billy Thomas, who became an NBA player, just a great shooter. Ryan Robertson, McDonald's All-American, who became an NBA player, who was a junior that year, right? He wasn't young. Mm-hmm. You had you and Lester Earl and TJ Pugh and Nick Bradford and Kenny Gregory. How the fuck did you guys not get to a Final Four?
Katina Mobley and Tyson Wheeler. I mean, literally, we only lost, we were 35-4 that year. We lost at Maryland, I remember early. We just didn't play well. And then we lost at Missouri, which is always tough to play at. And then, I don't know. They just,
can I tell you, I don't know if this happened in the Rhode Island game, but let me tell you about our game. So we played you guys only once that year. You guys won the league. You guys won 35 games. You guys won the league, but the league back then was separating the North and South, and we tied to win the South or whatever. We were picked last in the South. Anyway, so you guys play, so we're getting ready to play you. It's the last game of the year and it's on ABC. And Coach said, swear to God, he walks in, he goes, now listen, Kansas coming in here with Lester Earl and Kenny Gregory and Ryan Robertson and TJ Pugh and Chenoweth. Brother, they're good. Now, when they got Paul Pierce and Rafe LaFrenz on the court at the same time, they're better than us. About 8 to 10 points better than us. He's like, but I coached against Roy a long time. And he ain't going to take one of them out. He's going to take both of them out at the same time. And, brother, without Rafe LaFrenz and Paul Pierce in that court, we're better than them. And basically our game plan, I swear to God, our game plan was like, hey, let's just stay close. Just stay close. And then at some point, both of those two big motherfuckers are going to come out of the game. And that's when we go. If you go back and watch the tape, we lost that game by 4 points. You guys were probably 20 points better than it. Part of it was we started my boy Tom. We started the seniors on senior day, which is stupid, right? It's like one of those – that's great to do when you're playing,
Yeah, but they come out at the first dead ball.
Dude, we were down like 8-0. Like we don't need to spot Kansas 8 points, right? We don't need to spot Kansas 8 points. That is not a good idea. It's just not
– I still remember you knew our plays better than we did, I think. And we were running secondary break, and you turned your head to bait me to swing it, and then you popped back out and stole the swing pass. I'll never forget that.
No,
and
it's then, you guys do it. So I know all the Kansas shit because we loved it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You with that box set that goes into like little shuffle.
Yeah, that's B1. Yeah, it's B1. The cutter's coming across. You always try to jump it.
It's a steal every time because you guys are like robots, right? Because the big guys pop out. And then the big guy, and then, the point guard passes and then screens away for the other big guy, and it becomes a shuffle cut into a post-up, right? And, I mean, it was a layup, but yes, I do. I didn't know it was called B1, but thank you. I'll jot that down if I ever play against you.
B1, B2, B3.
Okay, so which one is the one? And then you fake that, right? You fake the pass, dribble to the middle, reverse B2. Dribble, and duck into the big guy.
That's B3.
Oh, it's B3.
Yeah, so B1's the standard scoring cut where, Rafe would come through and get a layup every time, which Carolina ran really well with Tyler, on that championship team and whatever year it was. And then B2 is a backdoor double. Basically, you fake it and you backdoor the one guy, and then Billy Thomas comes off a double screen the other side. And then B3 is where you dribble, and then you reverse pivot, and that's when the back cutter hooks this defender. Anyway, you stole the ball.
Yep.
And I remember you had a breakaway, and I fouled you pretty hard because obviously you can't shoot free throws to save your life.
Yes.
And it was just like getting the ball back. It was just a waste of time. It was a turnover on me, a steal for you, and then we just got the ball back.
I think I made one out of two, but I don't remember. Actually, the next year, my or the 2 years later, my senior year, when we kicked the dog shit out of you guys. You guys found me early, and I started making all my free throws. Do you remember what the locker room was like when you lost to Rhode Island?
Oh man, that was bleak. Because you remember the year before they got upset by Arizona, and in my opinion, I thought the 96-97 team was one of the best teams in college basketball history that never won. Had that team gone through and won the championship, they'd have been 40-1, and I would hang my hat on them saying they're the best team in college basketball history. I mean, I could really honestly say that. Lose to Arizona, so there's a ton of pressure on us, and then, you know, we're a one seed, Rhode Island's an eight seed, and I remember, like, in the second half, it kind of set in, we're like, we're in a game here, we're down 4 or 5, this is not going well. Coach starts freaking out in timeouts, he's getting on his hands and knees, begging Ryan Robertson to change the sides of the court, bringing the ball up. Stuff was rapidly out of control. Then Catino and Tyson were on fire. So, like, you saw it coming the last couple of minutes, and then when it's over, you get the locker room. It was just going through those emotions again. I mean, I was close to the team as a high school senior, but, like, now being in the locker room, it was like, God, this sucks. You know, I knew Rafe was done. Obviously, he's a senior, and we knew Paul was going to go. And it was just, I remember Matt Doherty being just pissed off. It wasn't like, he was sad. I remember our managers were like bawling in tears. I mean, I was kind of in shock. I looked over, my locker was next to CB. I looked at CB and he was just like on the ground with his head down. I've told people this a lot. Like, if you play a program like Kansas, if you don't win the national championship, your complete season is a failure. I don't care if you... If you go to the Final Four, okay, cool, that's fun. We get a banner, we get a ring, great. But, like, literally, if you don't win the championship, it's a complete failure. It really is, and that's the standard that Kansas has set, you know. And so it's a lot of pressure. It's too much pressure a lot of times for the players. And there's a few programs like that, Duke, Kentucky, Kansas. You know, if you don't win it, it's a total failure, you know. So, but that's the goals that we set, and that's the pressure we put upon ourselves. But I just remember how horrible that locker room was. It was nowhere you wanted to be. It was awful.
So you had a very good sophomore year. In your junior year, mm-hmm. that's when Gooden, Collison, Heinrich all show up. Why did you lose your starting? It ain't like Roy's going to cut you out of the family now. Why did you lose your starting spot?
Part of it, I think, was like a self-fulfilling prophecy for him. I mean, I really think it was. Like, I was the preseason all-everything guy. I'd come back, and, you know, I'd gotten on his nerves about a few things. And I remember, like, practice starting, and Nick and Drew were really good. And I was doing my thing, and we were doing fine. And then all of a sudden, like, I remember Coach Holiday was gone for a practice or two, and I was, like, asked Coach, I mean, where's Coach Holiday? He's like, oh, he's going to watch Cincinnati's practice with Coach Huggins for a couple of days because he's learning we're going to implement a press. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he goes, well, yeah, we're going to start, you know, we're going to speed up the tempo. We got so many guys, we're so deep. We're going to just, you know, we're going to press and change our style. And I remember thinking to myself, like, that's not what I kind of signed up for to come back for, whatever. And then, like I said, it just spiraled out of control. There was a lot of, I mean, Kansas has 5 beat writers. Like, the Yankees have 5 beat writers. Like, you know, so every article was, you know, Chenoweth sucks. And then it was, well, you know, Jason Whitlock's out there saying you got to bench Chenoweth. I mean, it was public. It was private. It just, and I'll tell you what it is. Like, and every player knows this. Like, confidence is everything in sports. I don't care who you are, what sport you play. Yep. If you have confidence and you believe you can get something done, you can get it done. Like what John Wooden said, whether you believe you can or you can't, you're probably right, right?
Right.
I lost my confidence. I mean, Coach didn't believe me anymore. Go ahead.
No, what do you think happened to me? Like, you and I grew up together. Like, I could shoot a basketball. Right. And then you get to this and you work all off season and you're like, all right, I got this shit. Right. And then, you know, and then you're in practice and you take one shot and your coach is like, no. Like, I remember I went to Notre Dame And when I was in high school, we played kind of how people play now, right? A lot of side and high ball screen, come down, shoot in transition, come off a ball screen and shoot, or get to the basket to score, get to the basket, kick off. And he was like, no, you have to develop a mid-range game. We had no secondary break. There was no transition threes. Like, I made a transition three. He took me out late in the season. And you just start to go like, fuck, he doesn't think I can make it. And for me, I think my problem would be I would work my ass off in the off season and really work. And then I get in the regular season, and it was so emotionally and mentally taxing to go through practices and everything that I got beat up a little bit in terms of how much I would work regular season. And so it would become kind of like, first I would miss, I'd have a bad practice, miss some shots. He'd say something about me trying to prove to everybody I could shoot. I get down on myself. I would work a little bit less, and the less I worked, obviously the results weren't as good, and it just kind of snowballed, right? So I totally get it. Like, it's really kind of amazing thing. And I think the other thing that's interesting is both you and I, like, we're kind of shit talkers, right? We grew up and we would talk shit on each other on Rome show back in the day. I don't know if our coaches, because I do think that Eddie Sutton, he would tell me, like, you're my whipping boy. You'll be my whipping boy till the day you finish it, right? Like, hey, that's actually not the way to coach me in terms of my offensive game, right? Like, I actually
when you learn that, it's too late. Like, you learn that late in the season or late in your career. It's like, because, like, I played for a really, really good high school, I mean, a great high school coach who rode me and, you know, MS'd me up and down the court and everything. But at the end of the day, like, I played every minute, and he had confidence in me to get the job done. And so it was a two-way street, whereas at the next level, it's different because and I'll tell you this. You said, what point did things go wrong? I remember it was like two or three games into the season, and coach always made us run after practice. And we were doing sprints, and, like, I didn't make a sprint one time because we had a two-and-a-half-hour practice, and then we're doing 33s. And he just singled me out and made me run until I threw up and everything. And I remember he stood over me one time when I was, you know, puking in a garbage can, and he said it very clearly and very loudly. He said, Eric, we don't need you. You need us. And when he said that, you know, now looking back, I probably should have had a conversation with my dad and say, hey, you know what? I need to, like, hire an agent, go to the draft or transfer or something, because this is him clearly saying that we've moved on from you, you know? And that, obviously, when you're 19 playing at KU and having a blast, like, you don't want to leave that program. But that's, now looking back, it's something I probably could have done and should have done.
Yeah, here would be my, as I look back at my own, because Coach Sutton would be like, you can't transfer, because back then you couldn't transfer twice. You know, like, I could have graduated early and transferred. And after my junior year, I led the country in assists, playing only 28 minutes a game because I was benched for like 8 games and barely played. Anyway, the transferring would have been, but honestly, if I could go back, I would have just had an honest conversation with him, right? Like, and I don't know if you were able to have that with Coach Williams, but just the idea of going to Coach Sutton and be like, look, like, again, I have these imaginary conversations with Coach Sutton. Had I just walked in and gone like, hey, listen, man, if you will just let me fire up 6 or 7 threes a game, I'll make a couple, like, right? And just not take, promise me you're not going to take me out. I'll take good shots because they're all good shots because nobody's fucking guarding me, right? Like, you just let me take a couple. Everything else will open up. Like, I know how to play bat. You don't have to tell me. You can yell at me all you want. Just don't. I just hated coming out. Right? I felt like I'd never get back in. And we had other guys on our team, Joe Atkins and Adrian Peterson, be like, fuck them, take me out. You can't win without me. And they'd come back in firing. Yeah. I just mentally couldn't do it, so I would shut down a little bit. And it would just kind of snowball. I'll remember clear as day. We played North Texas my senior year. And all through preseason, I'm going against Victor Williams, a kid who's a really good player after I finished. He transferred, he's redshirting from Illinois State. And he was hard for me. He's quick as shit. He's a AAU coach, workout guru in Kansas City now. And I had a really good preseason shooting the ball, but I was the only guy going against a legit high-level D1 player was guarding me because we didn't even up the sides when we played, and because coach didn't. Anyway, so we come out, we're playing North Texas, and they're, like, not guarding me at all. Guy at the free throw line. So I'm like, fuck it, I'm going to shoot every time I'm open.
We did the same thing.
No, I understand. We did the same thing. And I hit a couple against you guys, and slowly started guarding. So, but this is early in the year. So they're playing off me. I take 18 shots. I make six. Now, I come in the locker room, and now I should point out I had 18 assists or something, in like something crazy in the game. Like I had, I'm going to say like 15 points and 16 assists and like two turnovers or whatever. So I come in, and I've always grabbed a stat sheet as soon as I come in because like my brain is, what's everybody else doing? You know, I do want to see my numbers, but anybody who plays basketball at a high level usually know your own numbers for the most part, right? You're like, I know what I shot from the field. So he just rips the shit out of me and says, you know, all you care about is your stats and assists and points and you 16 or I don't know, 18 shots. Are you kidding me? I've never had a point guard in my life take 18 shots, right? So it's like ringing in my head like, look, they were all good shots. I was open. You know, and like his whole thing is like, don't take anything you can't prove to me. You can make 7 or 8 or 10 unguarded in a gym. And I would like, I'd make these shots in a gym. Anyway, we play Wichita State the next game and I'm so petrified to shoot. And now they're like not guarding me at all. And it just made life really hard. So I totally feel for you with the confidence thing. You know, you just kind of lost your confidence. Like how bad was it for you? Like what was that like?
How bad was it for me? I think it was about as bad as it could get, you know. You know, the collateral damage starts setting in because I was, you know, projected to be like a lottery pick and all those different things, and that was instantly taken away. So you see that go away with all the potential millions of dollars, which, you know, you even know about when you're a young kid in college. It was just, yeah, it was a really tough time. I remember, like, losing weight. I remember we were on a losing streak, and we all rallied together to shave our heads in solidarity. And so I looked gaunt and I was just awful. I mean, it was just a really, really bad time in my life, I remember. And so, and so I just remember after the season, we lost to Duke in Winston-Salem. And after the game, coach was addressing the team and he singled me out and called me out and said, you know, basically, you know, there's still a player there and you have a chance to redeem yourself. And I'm going to challenge you to take it upon yourself to, you know, have a summer where you can, you know, become the player you were once before and, you know, have a comeback. And it really inspired me. And I had one of the best summers anybody's had in the history of summer workouts. I remember Jay Billis did an article on my summer workouts and I was working out with Tim Gergerich and Bob Thornton and up at UCLA men's gym. I mean, I had a personal trainer. I did everything I could to get back to where I was. But you get back there, you play 10 games, and then things, you know, the damage is obviously still done. So I then obviously slipped to the second round, drafted by the Knicks, and started my professional career. But that what confidence is the most valuable thing any athlete could, you know, ever have. I'll tell you, I mean, health number one and confidence number two. And that was a shock for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's I think that in real sports, especially in basketball, confidence and maybe conditioning and kind of culture, kind of all those are three C's that I don't think in broadcasting or in fandom people understand, right? They don't get it. And, you know, that there are times where, you know, guys you just run out of gas. Your coach may have, and I wanted to ask you about Coach Williams in terms of his practices in a second, where you leave your, you know, you leave your game on the practice floor or your confidence. You know, sometimes coaches just don't know how to coach kids. Sometimes kids go through these swings in confidence. Some kids are not that good, but they believe they are that good. And some, they just make shots be like, that was Desmond Mason's thing. His senior year was coach would just fill him full of confidence and talk about how great he was, how hard he played, and like, that dude can't shoot, and damn if he didn't make shots. And he became a great shooter just because he believed, he would work more because of it, whereas some of the rest of us, we got beaten down because he never praised us, like literally never.
Correct.
Okay, I got a funny it wasn't, I'm sure, funny from your perspective, but let me share my perspective. So my senior year, this is your junior year, right, where you're suffering through, I think, or sophomore year, you're suffering through the malaise. Yeah, it was your junior year. You're suffering through the malaise.
We were only only a year apart, but in high school we were 4 years apart, but you sat out and transferred and redshirted and repeated grades over and over again.
So, yeah, No. What year did you graduate high school? 97?
97.
Okay, I graduated 95. That's not 4 years.
You should have been 94.
Yeah, no, yeah, sure. Yes. But you said in high school we were four years different. Like in high school we weren't. In eighth grade we would have been. Eighth grade, like, look, dude, when I was in eighth grade, this is a true story. When I was in eighth grade, I finished eighth grade at San Diego Middle School. Okay. I was 5 feet tall, 105 pounds. So my dad had told me, like, you're not ready. I wasn't emotionally, physically, anything ready for high school. During the 15 months between June of whatever that was, 1990. And September of 1991, okay, in 15 months. When I entered high school at Tustin High School in 1991, I was roughly like 5'9", 5'9½, 125 pounds, right? That's like how much I had grown during that time period. And that year was a total wash, like athletically, everything. Like I understand that, like, redshirting, and it's gotten to the point of being ridiculous, and we copied kind of the Marinovich model a little bit.
You were 19 when you graduated high school.
Yeah.
So anyway, so we're getting off on a tangent.
My junior year, we lose to you guys. The only time I played at Fog, and that was the shorts on backwards game. But what people don't know about that game is a couple of things. Like, one, I had a couple open shots in the last possession that I turned down, and we ended up kind of getting no shot, and Fred Yancey had missed a front end. Like, we should have beaten you in regulation, and we didn't. And coach never won up there.
Whatever.
And then we lost.
Uncle Rico comments, we beat you, fair and square. That's how it went.
Hold on, dude. Robertson catches the ball in overtime.
And you fouled him. He got fouled.
He did not foul him. I mean, we can put the video out.
Classic.
It is.
Every year. I watch it every
it's
year.
It's one of the... I mean, like, when Vital, who, you know, is, oh, it's one of the worst calls I've ever seen. Anyway, so this is junior year. We lose up in Lawrence. And late at night, we have to stay overnight in Lawrence. And so we go out to the Village Inn to get something to eat. And who's there but Ryan Robertson, who I'm jealous of because he's the starting point guard at Kansas, and that's one of the places I wanted to go. Plus, he gets this fucking bullshit call on senior night to save him because he didn't play well. Plus, he doesn't like me because in Sports Illustrated, I said Kansas is really good except for their guards, right? And it's true. Our guards were better than your guards. I mean, you know, Boshi's a good dude and a good coach, and he ain't as good as Joe Atkins, and nobody was as good as Adrian Peterson, and Desmond Mason technically is a guard, and you know, I thought I was better than Ryan, so like we had some dudes in the backcourt. Anyway, so I go up to Ryan, and I was like, hey man, congrats, but God, that was a bullshit call, bullshit way to end a great game, and he's like, what are you talking about? It's fucking foul. What are you talking about? Like, he was so defensive about it, that it was. So fast forward to my senior year, and we don't play you guys until, I think, later in the year. You're not playing very much. He's going with the younger dudes, with Heinrich and Collison and Gooden. And we kick the fucking dog shit out of you guys. We're up so many points in the second half. We went to delay game. We just started running our delay game stuff. Coach calls the timeout. I was like, hey, I got to go to Lawrence next year. Take it easy. We're not no fast breaks. Just take it easy. Anyway, so here's the big question. So we're up, like, we're seriously up 40, and coach is, you know, doing everything he can to, like, actually, it was 18 in the first half, and Boshi hits like an NBA three before the break, like deep three, somebody doesn't guard him, and we come in, and guys are screaming at each other, like, who the fuck left him open? And coach is like, I'm telling you, they're coming, brother. Boshi hit that three. Like, we were so petrified that all of a sudden you guys would wake up, and, you know, second half starts and Desmond goes crazy and I make a couple shots. And, like, when I make shots, the shit is over. I even made free throws that night. And so we're in delay game. So it's probably, again, my memory's really good, but this part I don't remember. It felt like it was like 8 minutes to go in the game and you guys start fouling me, right, to get to the bonus to make me shoot free throws. And Boshi fouls me, gets his fourth foul. And the staff turns up, sums up, is like, don't foul, you have four. The ball comes inbounds the very next play, and he fouls again, and he's like, fuck this. And he goes and sits down. And Coach Williams didn't stand up. Okay, so do you guys, like, there was a lot of pummeling wins you guys have. Do you remember? It felt like you guys gave up.
Well, I didn't give up. I remember my minutes were really short at that time, so I didn't really have a chance to contribute to do much. But I remember that game was over before it started. It was like before the first TV timeout. It was like we were down 12. And like I said, that was a part of the season where, you know, we hated practices. We were, you know, losing games. We lost 10 games that year. And so, and I don't know, that was towards the end of the season. So we had lost, you know, 8 or 7 games, something like that. And Coach had tried everything. He you know, canceled practice and we go bowling. He ran us. We did everything. And we just wouldn't click, you know. Just, I don't know, you know, there was, that was just a tough time of the year. So that was one of those situations where I've never given up, but it was just, I vividly remember, you know, Jeff making that foul and kind of walking off the court and untucking his shirt and like plopping down. Like, I remember that, but like, yeah, that was not a fun night. I'm sure it was for you guys.
No, actually, go ahead. Go tell me your funny story. I have one too. Go ahead.
So my parents had seen a million games at Allen Fieldhouse. So they were like, hey, we want to start going seeing games like in these other Big 12 towns. So my parents were at that game. And I remember, I don't know if you remember this, but I think it was my senior year we were playing there. But my mother was...
No, senior year you didn't play there. Senior year you didn't play there.
Okay, well then it was my junior year. My mother was battling cancer. And she, you know, she was stage 3, but she was going to make it. And I remember, you know, your fans, there was a section right behind our bench and they would chirp at us, which is fine. But then one guy said something like, yeah, go home and cry to your mommy, Chenoweth. And so the subject of my mother was so delicate at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, my dad, he's an ex-college football player, 6'2", you know, 300 bills at the time. I looked back, and all I saw was my dad going straight for this guy. And I was like, oh, shit, you know, this is going to be national news. This is like, and luckily, there was a state trooper that we had behind the bench, and he heard and saw the whole thing and grabbed my dad and basically said, don't do this. This isn't worth it. They kicked the guy out, and that was it. But I remember, like, it just... one thing after another. That was just a horrible, horrible year, horrible time. My mom was sick. I was losing my you know, my draft spot. I mean, I was falling in the second round. We were losing games. I lost one of my best friends at home who passed away, you know, in a motorcycle accident in the summer. It was the pits. It was awful. And so, you know, just talking about it now brings back all those emotions.
Sorry about that.
You know, I know, but you know what? The good news is my mother, you know, she's 20 years past. She's made it through, you know, and I ended up getting to play pro and things are going well now. So we made it through, but it was a really dark, tough times back then.
Yeah. I mean, like, again, my junior year was crazy dark too. Like, I led the country in assists, but I went through this thing where I got a T, and we lost to Florida Atlantic, and I got a bad T, and we lost this game to a shitty team. I actually had 18 assists and played well. And
of course you did.
And then we played UCLA at the Pond, and I get 2 T's in the first half, and we lose by 3. And so I'm like, and then Glenn Alexander gets eligible, so I'm the odd man out, and he benches me for like 8 games. You know, I'm petrified to shoot, to do anything other than like be a robot out there. And and we massively underachieved. We were a top. If we would have played all our small guys and played small ball the way that we played small before everybody else played small with Mason at the 4, we played Mason at the 5 one time against Texas and came back and made it a close game, but he just wouldn't do it. Like, we could have won the whole thing playing small. Anyway, my point is, like, my junior year was the shits too. Like, it's really, really hard. And I can't imagine, like, one of the great things about being me, like, look, in Stillwater, I was a pretty big thing or whatever, but I'm still a 6-foot white guy who can throw on a hat and a hoodie and disappear. Like, you're a 7-footer at Kansas, and anywhere you go, everybody knows you. What's that? I've always wondered, like, what's that existence like when you awful. Literally it cannot hide.
It was awful, man. And I remember, like, the KU has a school paper, the UDK, and you know, they pile it on the campus, so everybody reads this thing. And in the UDK, the University of Daly, Kansas, there's a section called the free-for-all. And you can call in to an 800 number and say whatever you want, and they will print it in the free-for-all section of the UDK. And so literally for about 2 months straight, every time the first comment was, Chenoweth sucks. And then literally these are drunk frat boys or whatever calling in, and they would print this. And so, you know, obviously all school papers have the crossword puzzle, so you always want to get to that. But, like, I remember just, I grab it every day, I sit down, and boom, it's right there. And then you look around, and you're in a classroom with, maybe it's a lecture hall, there's 200 people in there, people are kind of looking back at you. And then maybe you're in a smaller class, and there's 40 people in there reading it and looking up at you. It's like, you cannot escape it. In Lawrence, Kansas, there's 100,000 people in the city, there's 20,000 students. Everywhere you go, everywhere you walk. And it was really, really really awful time. The one saving grace was my roommate and teammate, Jeff Carey, who became one of my best friends in the whole world. And we would, you know, he was just incredibly supportive of me and such a good friend. And I don't know what I would have done without him, because he was a big guy. And so we'd go through practice together, and he saw all the stuff that was going on. He saw me lose support from every different angle. And he was really incredible. And I had a really nice girlfriend at the time. She was really helpful too. But, like, if it wasn't for those two people, like, I can't explain. It was really dark times. It was really, really hard.
So if you could go back and do it again, you would have left after your left when he kind of when he's
no,
he,
I would have left after my sophomore year. Listen to this. So my sophomore year, I was the third player in Kansas basketball history to average a double-double in conference play. Will Chamberlain, Ray Flafrentz, Eric Chenoweth. The only three players at that time, there's been players to do it since, but in that time, only three players in Kansas history to average a double-double in conference play. And then I think I averaged like 14 and 10 or something like that. Had a really good year. I mean, I showed all my strengths and all those different things. And I remember, like, when you get recruited to go to Kansas, the coach gives you this, like, 4-year plan. Okay, freshman year, you're all freshman. Honorable mention, all conference. And then sophomore year, you're going to be all conference. And then all, junior year, you're all American. And then senior year, player of the year. And so you had all these different goals that set out that you wanted to attain. And I saw Rafe stay all 4 years. I saw Scott Pollard stay for all 4 years. I saw Paul stay 3 years. And back then, guys just didn't leave that early. I remember Elton Brand left, and it was like, wow, you know, he's only a sophomore. Well, so I had a meeting with Coach, and he was like, yeah, Eric, you know, you can go out and be a top 15 pick, but you can come back and be a number one pick, you know. And I'm like, yeah, Coach, I'm going to come back and be a number one pick. Well, people, what I know now, and especially what I do for a living now, your window to get in the NBA is very, very, very small. Very small. And some guys can trick the system and sneak in the first round and get 4 years in the league and wash out. Some guys, you know, can have a different path to get to the NBA. But for the most part, your window to get there is very small. So if anybody ever tells you, hey, you're the top 15 pick, you have to go. You could buy all the insurance in the world. You can do everything you want. But there's too many different variables that can happen when you come back. And think about this. When you come back, or the combine or whatever, it's a devaluation period. When you're playing in the games, you're playing well, you're doing things you're supposed to do, it's an evaluation period. So when you come back after a really good year, all scouts are going to do is try to pick apart what you can't do, right? So I remember talking to a bunch of scouts.
I don't know if I totally agree with that. I'll give you an example. And look, this is a discussion. This is not a, we don't have to go into, you feel free to hop in. Okay.
Yeah.
But you take, I remember Harrison Barnes. Okay. And,
He got to the Warriors and didn't know how to play. I talked to the people at the Warriors, and they're like, "Yeah, he doesn't know how to play."
I understand,
he was a great player in the system.
But wait, you're telling me one thing and then saying the opposite, right? You're saying that Harrison Barnes should leave after his freshman year,
yes.
But he didn't know how to play, right? So It's well, like
because of the system he came from, though. That's different. Like he didn't.
Well, here let me share with my perspective here. Okay, so again, okay. And I don't echo everything that every NBA scout says, because everybody has a different system of evaluation, right? But for me, you know, I watched him. He played 2 years at North Carolina, and obviously the second year he averaged like a point and a half more. He shot like 2 percentage points higher from the field. He shot, I think 1% or 2 percentage points higher from three. Okay? But the game was much easier. But like, look, I thought he got better. Now, he would have been a top 10 pick if he came out his first year. He would have been a top 10 pick if he came out his second year. But there's the, I understand the idea that all they do is pick you apart. All they do is pick you apart. My thing is, I try and pick apart, like, hey, has he improved? Is he getting better? What's his body? Like, I think, honestly, you need 2 years of college because, one, I want to see you the second year when you're more comfortable in a system. Because as you said earlier in the pod, like, your first year, shit's moving so fast and you're just a robot. Mm-hmm. And they're not really, you know, look, we did this at Oklahoma State. Like, my first year even as a transfer, like, they don't really coach you the first half of the year because they don't want to freak you out and they don't want. And then all of a sudden, like January comes and they start screaming at you in film, like, "What the fuck are you doing here?" You're like, "Well, sorry, you didn't yell at me last week. What happened?" You're like your second year. Now the road games don't bother you. Coaching doesn't bother you. You can just kind of be like your second and third years when you kind of find your. And I think for scouts, you need that second year to see, all right, has this guy figured out? Can he run an offense? Can he figure out scouting reports? Has he improved from year one to year two? What's his body look like? Because guys' bodies change dramatically between 18 and 21. You're kind of saying, hey, you should go right away, but then saying like a Harrison Barnes, like he got there and he didn't know how to play basketball.
He didn't know how to play NBA basketball. That's what I'm saying. He didn't know how to play in an NBA-type system. He knew the Carolina system, which, you know, secondary break, B1, B2, B3, which we discussed and all those different things. But he didn't – I'm not going to name the name, but someone from the Warriors said he did not know how to play. He didn't know how to play. And so – but no – there's no exact formula across the board. Every situation is different. And I'm just saying in my situation, I'd played 2 years. Yeah. And I remember – and I know Mark Workenstein very well. I've known him forever. And I've known him since I was, I don't know, fifth, sixth grade. He told me, I remember 2 years later, I saw him. He said, Eric, he was at Portland at the time. He said, we were going to trade up to get to 16 to pick you. He said, there's no way in hell you would have fell past 16. And if you look at that draft, the first big guy drafted was Elton Brand at, I don't know what he went with, it was high. The second 7-footer picked was a European who was playing on a JUCO in Kansas who went 12, who never played in the NBA ever. I don't know the guy's name. I got to look it up. But I remember sitting back watching the draft, and I was like, what the hell? Like, I had known at that point I'd made the wrong decision I probably should have done because you could get there. But on the flip side, I had the goals of getting to a Final Four, being an All-American, all those different things. So, and I'll tell you what, Doug, I don't know when the trend started of one and done, but Lester Earl's another example. Lester Earl should have never gone to college. He should have gone straight to the NBA out of high school. And he would have played in the league for 10-plus years. He went to college. He transferred from LSU. He sat out, knee issues, bad medical care. And then all of a sudden he's done, and now he's, you know, starting a new life, doing something, not playing basketball. You look at the paths and decisions that people take, and if they have the right guidance and make the right decision, it's amazing what can happen in your life and in your career at such a young age.
So here's the question about Lester Earl, okay? There's the question about Lester Earl. I'm going to disagree with you in terms of he might have, yeah, like you talk about fooling. By the way, it was Alexander Radovich from Barton Community College. And then Cal Boulder.
Could have played that.
Cal Boulder went 17 to Atlanta out of ODU. He played 3 years in the league. Man, it was a bad big guy draft. Bad big guy draft.
So that's your window. That's what I'm talking about.
Right, right. Like, so
even if I wasn't ready, at least you get there and you get washed out or whatever, at least you make it. You know what I mean? And that's half the battle, is just getting there.
Right. I would say, though, that it's like, I think for the NBA, I think it's a mistake to take the guys out of high school because you can't tell. Like I remember Sebastian Telfair. That was it 04, whatever the big, or 05, mm-hmm. whatever the big, maybe it was 05, the last big high school draft. It was Dwight Howard was in it, and the McDonald's All-American game was in Oklahoma City, and I was broadcasting it for ESPN, and, you know, you watch the workouts, and every night we'd go to Beers, the place that became Durant's bar was some other bar there. And I remember sitting around with a bunch of these guys, was like, which one of you guys is going to lose your job over Sebastian Telfair? They're like, what do you mean? I was like, he can't play fucking basketball. Like, he can't play. They're like, what do you mean? I was like, look, he can make the passes, but he can't shoot. He doesn't know when to do what. He just knows, like, if I get the ball, every time I get the ball, my job is to try and break the guy down, get to the rim, and if help comes, kick off for a dunk. Like, that's it.
Yeah, get buckets. Yeah.
Right, but it's not even just get buckets. It's just like and that's not how you play basketball. Like, you got to move sometimes the best play is just to pass the ball and get the fuck out of the way. And he had no idea how to play. And you could see in his interactions, like, he didn't really understand how to be a leader, even though guys looked up to him. He was so interested in being bassy that he wasn't, like, you just watch, you're like, this is a disaster. This is bad. That kid needs college. He needs a coach motherfucking him for a couple years.
For every example like that, there's another example of someone who did make the right decision by going early or what have you. And so, and for him, I mean, his older brother played in the NBA. I mean, he was, but here's the thing too.
Who,
he maxed out at a young age. And so his brother Mel, he had a half brother, step brother that played in the NBA.
Jamel Thomas?
Yes.
I don't think Jamel ever played in the NBA, but I played with him in the ABA.
I played with him in Knicks Summer League. So I know him. He's a great guy, by the way.
He is a great guy.
But I mean,
And a good player, and he went by five. I wasn't allowed to come, so we played. This is a true story. I played with Phoenix with him in the ABA. This is a true story. I didn't even know until a couple weeks ago that our nickname was the Eclipse, the Phoenix Eclipse. I played for a team, and I didn't know. And Maz Track was my coach.
Maz is my coach,
and he goes, and I just got the plane from Israel. I left my team in Israel to come play for Maz and for the Phoenix team, and they had Jamel was there, and I played against Jamel in college at Notre Dame, and I was like, what up, Mel? He's like, don't call me that. I was like, excuse me? He's like, I go by five. I'm like, what? He's like, Jamel's my government name. He was in this, like, that's my government name, and call me five. Okay, so
I remember.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was summer league with the Knicks, and Cliff and Tibbs and Jeff Van Gundy only called him Mel. They did, and I don't think he's going to tell the coach not to call him Mel, but we called him Mel.
Okay, so you get drafted in the second round of the NBA draft.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what happened then?
Immediately on a flight out to New York, you know, staying at the Marriott Residence Inn on Barker Avenue in White Plains, New York. And then it was me. They drafted Michael Wright, God rest his soul, after me, two picks after me. And so it was me and him, Steve Clifford, Tom Thibodeau, at SUNY Purchase every day for 6 hours. I mean, it was literally, it was hot gym, no AC, and we would do, you know, workout starts at 9, so you get there at 8:30 or so, get dressed, get out there, you stretch, loosen up. We do 2 hours, literally 2 hours of spot shooting drills, ball handling, different drills, whatever. Break, get lunch, go back, lift weights for an hour, cardio for an hour. And mind you, this is New York in the summer, which you lived up there, you know how it is. It's brutal. But every day, all the way leading up to camp. And I remember, then obviously I was, you know, I did on September 11th, I had an appearance with Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, was doing a healthy living promotion. So I was on 42nd and 2nd at the Pfizer Pharmaceuticals building, doing a promotion there. When the two planes hit, I had to obviously walk up to the Upper East Side and take a train out of the city back up to White Plains. But I remember, you know, going through that summer, going through that event on September 11th, and then kind of feeling like I earned my stripes, you know, I thought, okay, I have a chance to make this roster. And I remember, like, a week before camp, Jeff Van Gundy pulls me in his office and he goes, hey Eric, I just want you to know that you're not going to make this team, so do whatever you got to do. It's something of the sort like that. And so I was like, it was pretty hard pill to swallow just because, you know, I'd worked so hard, I'd been through so much, I was developing relationships with the guys on the team, and then all of a sudden at the 11th hour when all camp spots are full, I get the rug pulled out and I got to scramble to find a place to go. And so, and I later on, I heard the backstory behind this where Scott Layden really liked me and wanted to pick me. And so they were in the war room of draft night, and I guess guys were throwing out names, and Scott Layden kind of pounded the table and said, "Nope, we're picking Chenoweth." And everybody, half the room was good with it. Half was like, "Oh God, here we go." And so, it just, you know, obviously they kept Michael Wright till the very last second and cut him with 48 hours left on the waiver line. And so, you know, it was a really, I'm not making excuses. They gave me an opportunity, which I appreciate, but it was a really difficult situation for me. I went to camp with Sacramento. They already had 15 guaranteed spots. Basically, I went there to get a pair of socks, whatever, and go to camp, get the feel. And then it was off to the D League and overseas, and my journeyman career started from there. But, I do remember being drafted and how good of a feeling that was and how exciting it was. And it was a really nice moment to share with my family and especially my mom, who had just beaten cancer. And so it was, you know, a sign of a comeback, not a full comeback. Obviously, I wish I had gone in the first round. But it was that was actually a really good time in my life opposed to the 2 years before, you know.
Yeah. Okay, then you, 1 year you had a, I thought you were going to make the Lakers. Like, that one made sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah, that was interesting. So, in I remember I went to camp with, like I said, it was the Knicks, then I went to Sacramento for camp in D-League, and then in 2002 I went to camp with Seattle, got cut there, and went to the D-League. And I remember I was playing in the D-League, and I got, I remember it was Valentine's Day of, like, 2003, the coach, he cut me on the tarmac. He's like, "Eric, this isn't working out. We're going to let you go." And I said, "Okay." So my agent called me with a bunch of different opportunities overseas and whatever. And I said, "You know what? I need to get back to the drawing board." And I remember I came home. I hired a guy named Todd Norman, who's a trainer at the Cutting Edge here in Orange County. So I just dedicated myself to improving my body, getting mentally, you know, strong, physically stronger, all those different things. I started working out with an individual coach named Jody Gardner, who's out here, is a really good individual guy. And then when all the NBA guys came back for the summer, Sean Rook, Sean Marks, and all those guys, you know, I just dedicated myself to becoming a better athlete, becoming a better player. And I remember the Lakers, you know, invited me to the summer league team, and I played really well on that team. And then they invited me to camp. And I remember, you know, I felt like Phil liked me because Coach Jackson liked me because I, you know, challenged Shaq at the time. I'd gotten up to 295 pounds, and I was pretty well put together at the time because before I'd been a little skinny. So I'd put my, you know, I was benching 330 pounds. I was squatting 400 pounds, and I was in really, really good shape, and I was really strong. And so Phil liked the fact that I could challenge Shaq in practice. And so, you know, I had that entire summer every day at the facility working out. And then, you know, working out with Coach Rambis, and the whole staff there was fantastic. And so we get to camp, and actually Phil started me in a couple of games, which was pretty crazy. We had a TNT game at Staples Center, and Phil wrote up on the board Chenoweth. And I'm like, I looked around, and I was like, this is a shoot-around. And so I knew all day I was going to start for the Lakers. And I'll never forget Gennaro Pargo. We were walking through our cars, and he's like, "Damn, Chan, you started for the Lakers, man." And he was like teasing me about it. And Kareem Rush was, and Luke Walton and Brian Cook, all those guys were like, "Man," like, and I, for a split second, I was like, "I'm going to make this team. This is crazy." And then I remember Steve Kerr, who's a buddy, and I really respect him. He was like, "You know, I've been monitoring Eric for his, you know, short career so far, and I think he's good enough to make it. And I think Eric's going to make this roster." And I remember my dad hearing that. I mean, everything was aligned to make the team.
So
and
what
then
happened?
Right towards the Brian Russell hurt his knee, and he required surgery. He was going to be out for 2 months. And so Mitch called me in and said, "Eric, we cannot cut someone if they're not healthy. You have to pass your exit physical in order to be released." Well, he cracked his knee and had surgery, whatever, and they said, "We can't cut him, so we're going to cut you." And that one, really, really stung because I'd done so much to get to that point. I'd really developed a good relationship with Shaq. Kobe even respected me, I felt like, a little bit. We did the Kings drill where there's four big men, one-on-one in the post. It was me, Shaq, Karl Malone, Samson, and another big guy. I can't remember who was. Horace Grant. One-on-one in the post to five. And it, Shaq, Karl, all these names. And I won the first one to five. I won it. It's called the Kings game. And when we came back to the center, and, like, Phil was like, who won? And I didn't say anything. I just stood there with my mouth shut, and Shaq was like, "Yo, the big fella wanted." And Kobe looked at me and, like, gave me, like, a punch on the chest, like, "All right, OC," because I'm from Orange County. He called me OC. Yeah. And that was, like, a feeling of, like, wow, I'm, like, I'm going to make it. But anyway, and then Brian Russell, fast forward 2 years later, I was in camp with the Nuggets. Same thing happened there, too. I had a really good chance of making the team, and he got hurt again. And they had to keep him. So that was my fortune, and that's how it goes. But that's, you know, but still, that month with the Lakers in camp was the best experience I've ever had in my life in any level. It was
so
amazing.
Fun. So the thing I liked about, I was with the Lakers three different times, and I did Summer League. Was it 01 Summer League? 01 Summer League. This is when you were at the Knicks. And I played in the Summer League team. And then all 3 years I did, like, they had a vet mini camp before you went to Hawaii. And, like, the first year, I literally flew back from Italy. I was with the team in Italy, and I thought I had the shot to. It was me and Mike Pemberthy, and I did everything better than Mike Pemberthy, except that dude could fucking shoot. Like,
he had a stroke.
I mean, yeah. He coaches with him now. I mean, he can fucking just shoot the fucking ball. And I didn't really, and, like, triangle's a bad offense for me, but, you know, Tex helped me get in there. And then they liked me, and they're like, hey, you know, go play overseas and come back. So I came back from Russia, and now I was good. But they had also brought in Pemberthy and Joe Crispin, who can also fucking shoot. And both those dudes made it, and I didn't. And then the third year, those guys, I think the third year, those guys were both kind of embedded in the roster. And by then I was, like, I was good. Like, I could hoop, and I had gotten rid of some of the mental shit, and I understood the offense. But, you know, it's like, look, you, like, a limited shooter, as a, no matter how good athletically or off pick and roll you are in that offense as a third point guard, like, they don't really fucking need you. But what I loved about the Lakers was they treated every dude like even when I knew I wasn't going to make it, like, I'd come in, I'd get massages, I'd work out, like, they treat you just like you're on the team. But there is something to that. When you walk down that, as you know, you walk in, you say hi to the receptionist, and you walk, and then you see these pictures of all these incredible Lakers. You're like, fuck, I could be on the Lakers. I'm, like, this close.
I know.
And then Mitch comes in. He's like, hey, man, we think you're great. You should really think about the D-League, and we think about calling you up. And we're like, wait, that I was just walking down thinking I was making the team. Anyway. Okay, so.
Yeah.
So what you do now is you insure some of the great athletes in college. Like, how did you get into this, and what do you actually do?
Yeah, so thanks. Good question. So, obviously, retired in 08, got into coaching for a couple of years, made no sense. So, in 2012, my full-time job was finding a job. And I almost took a job at AEG. Philip Anschutz was a, you know, KU guy, so he floated my resume and almost did something there. And right before I did it...
Wait. Philip Anschutz is a KU guy. I want to make sure that people understand this, okay?
Okay.
This is my big thing. Okay. And I understand what you're saying about going straight out of high school to the pros if you can. The problem with it, by my estimation, is there'll be so many kids that go, they'll end up in the G League. They don't understand. Everyone talks about the value of college, and it pisses me off when they go, there's no value to college. First, like, there's lots of jobs you can't have without a degree. But the big thing you get in college is, like, you're part of that school and basketball programs family. And here's the perfect example. If you wanted to get into coaching, I'm guessing Coach Williams, Carolina family, there's you could find NBA or college, somebody would find a chair for you, correct?
A very, very small chair, grinder chair, but at least it's a chair.
Correct.
The job offers I got was like $30,000 as a video coordinator in XYZ.
Right, but look, CB started there, and look where he is now. And look at, like, that's.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like, I understand that Coach Williams. I mean, that's. I mean, look, Coach Williams started as a manager, and now he's, you know, he's arguably the most successful coach, you know, in the history of the sport. So, okay, the other part is, like. like you said, like Phil VanCleef can make a call for you because he's a Kansas guy. And I don't know if enough people understand, like, this is really the way it works, is what you need college for is when, shit, I need it. Like, before Boone Pickens died, and I didn't have, I knew him, we weren't, like, best friends or whatever, but if I really legitimately needed a job, I would have called Boone and said, hey, can you help me out? And he would have said, tell me who to call and I'll figure it out, right? There is a value to that.
100%. And I talk about this all the time, too. We can talk about, you know, a million different things with the name, image, likeness stuff. But the network that I've tapped into and work in on a daily basis with KU has changed my life. So think about KU, which is an amazing institution. It's a great place to go to school and people to work with. Think if you went to, like, Stanford or an Ivy League school, like the value in those relationships with all those people in Silicon Valley and all those different things, that is dismissed so much, and it's ridiculous. And so really quick, so like my full-time job was finding a job, so I reached out to Ant Schutz is the secretary, and he got to him, and I said, here's my resume. And along with that resume was Dana Anderson, who was the president and chairman of the board of the Macerich Corporation, which is a massive strip mall company that he was chairman of the board on, who's a huge donor for KU, who helped me with a resume, helped me prepare for interviews, all these different things, you know, guided me along, who was amazing in my, you know, transition out of basketball into the professional world. You know, he said, here's who you got to call to get to Philip. And so I got Philip. So Philip literally said, I'll float your resume. That's all it was, is this is coming down from the man. And actually, Stu Heathcote, who you might know, was a Reebok guy, UCLA guy. He's now Global Partnerships, picked it up and got me an interview. And he was going to find out a way to get me in there, you know. And that's all because of the A in AEG. It really is. So that's what people need to think about. So, and we can talk about how valuable college is, you know, down later. But I was going to take a job there, and I grew up with the Boone family, Aaron and Matt. Matt's my best friend, my son's godfather. And so Aaron's best friend is, his partner's a partner at a firm called Park Advisors in Beverly Hills, Ryan Stromsborg. And so they were like, hey, before you take that job, you should go meet with these guys in Beverly Hills. They do insurance for athletes. And I was like, oh, well, I had a policy when I played at Kansas. I know how this works as a consumer. Let's figure this out. So we had a two-hour meeting. They kind of hired me on the spot and said, let's go. So that was in 2013, or September of 12 is when I joined this firm. And so what was great for me was I was begging coaches for jobs for 3 years and immediately turned my hat and said, listen, coach, I'm not going to bug you about, you know, getting a job. Here's what I do now. Here's how I can help you. And every coach came back and said, oh, my God, I don't understand this stuff. I know you. I trust you. Like, you're our guy. And so I was immediately plugged into, you know, Carolina, Kansas. Well, Kansas took some time, obviously, which is a side story. But it was immediately, I was like, here's your opportunity. Like, you know, whatever coaches recruited me 20 years ago were now saying, hey, I got this guy. What does he qualify for? What should we do here? And my business model was simple in that I called coaches and I called compliance officers. Because I remember when I was at KU, I had a coach. My dad said, Eric, you should get a policy. I went and talked to coach. Coach said, yeah, go talk to Richard Consman down the hall in compliance. I'll take it from there. So I knew all I'm going to do is call compliance directors and develop relationships with them. And so now fast forward 8 years later, I have my own firm now. And basically what happens is I monitor all the draft boards for college football, baseball, basketball, and hockey. And as soon as guys enroll in school, I'm reaching out to the school saying, hey, here's the student athlete that just enrolled. Here's what he qualifies for. Here's what we can do for him. And then we go from there. If they utilize my services, great. If not, you know, it's fine too. But what really took off in my career, which was crazy, was when I played, I had to get a loan and pay off the loan once I turned pro to pay for the insurance. Well, my second year in the business, the NCAA changed the rules with the Student Assistance Fund, allowing them to have the schools to have full autonomy on the SAF. So the SAF was designed for emergency room visit bills, you know, diapers if a player has a child, you know, flights home for funerals, suits if you travel, things like that. Well, once they get in full autonomy, Texas A&M said, well, we got a big offensive lineman that needs a policy. We're going to spend $50,000 on his policy. And so it's a copycat everything. And so it kind of took off like wildfire, where 2 years I was helping these kids get loans to buy the insurance. Now it was, hey, we're going to do this, and we're going to pay for it. And so it really took off from there.
So the schools can pay for these policies now?
Correct, yes. And they can pay for it out of what's called the Student Assistance Fund. Based on cost of attendance, cost of living, a couple factors, each school gets a check from the NCAA for approximately $250,000 to $300,000 that they can use for whatever they want. Some schools use the whole thing for insurance. Some schools don't use it. But I'm, you know, out of 60 schools I work with, I would say about 95% of them use a portion of it for insurance. And so, and I'll talk about how great college is because of what it can do for you later in life. How about this? I have a client on a team in the Big Ten, a private school in the Big Ten. So he's getting a scholarship.
There's only one private school in the Big Ten. I hate to be like, you're kind of getting that.
Well, actually, no, it's not private now that I think about it. So, but it costs about $45,000 a year to go there. Okay. So he's got a $45,000 scholarship. Between Pell Grant, Grant and Aid, all these different things, he gets a check for $27,500, which he can use at his discretion for whatever he wants. And he's got a $2 million policy, so if his career ends, he collects $2 million to start a new life with. That's a pretty good life, if you ask me. I mean, I think that's a that's better than playing in a D-League. That's better than, you know, I don't know how good it is, a life it is being on a practice squad in the NFL or the minors in NHL or the minors in Major League Baseball. That's pretty amazing to have for 3 or 4 years while you're on campus and then to go to the next level, which kind of goes back to another conversation I'm sure we'll get to. So that's what I do. I work with, you know, college athletes all over the country. Once they turn pro, I work in conjunction with their financial advisor or agent. I'm really busy with it right now because guys are in NBA training camp and they may have, you know, $150 million on the table, but they want $176 or whatever they want over 4 or 5 years. So we'll bind them in a $20, $30, $40 million, $50 million policy, whatever they need. To cover their future earnings until they sign. Once they sign, obviously the insurance has done its job. And then I follow up to sell them life insurance for estate planning purposes. So, so that's all I do. I just do insurance. I don't do investments or tax prep or anything like that. I just do insurance, which allows me to work with college and professional athletes. And so doing that 8 years, and it's I love it, and I'll do it forever. So that's what I'm doing now.
Okay, Last thing, I got two quick ones. One,
yeah.
Has anybody actually ever executed one of these policies?
You mean collected on one?
Yes.
Yeah, I've had several claims paid. I've had a college football loss of value claim paid. I've had an NBA basketball player loss of value claim paid, and I've had a college football PTV claim paid. I don't name names. I'm not that guy. There's other brokers out there that'll tweet out all that stuff. I keep it confidential, but. So there's three products you can get. There's permanent total disability, which is career-ending coverage. Whether you can't play your sport ever again, you collect on PTD due to an injury or illness, right? There's loss of value. We assess your draft spot, and we assess, okay, you're projected 10th in the draft. We're going to set a threshold at the end of the first round. If you get hurt or have an injury or an illness, you fall out of the first round, you'll start collecting each pick you fall. That's loss of value in a nutshell. And then there's a new product called critical injury, which is two categories of injury. So if you Category one being a major injury such as a torn ACL, Achilles, rotator cuff, Tommy John, if you're a pitcher, loss of sight or cancer, you collect $250,000. And then category two would be a major muscle group tear, so torn groin, bicep, tricep, hamstring, quadricep, you get a $100,000 benefit. So those are, you start with a PTD and you add loss of value or critical injury as a rider. Loss of value is kind of going away. There's been a ton of claims paid on it, so they're only doing it for the top guys. But most guys, if they're a solid player, are going to qualify for the critical injury rider that they can add to their PTD policy.
Okay, and here's the last thing. I'll kind of give you the floor, but I mean, like, look, people know that I value the college system for among the things that we've said. But the name and likeness fight, which to me, it's going to be pay for play, right? Like, guys don't really have and in fairness, I when I tweet out that guys don't have a value, they don't have a huge value. But what you do is you pool together all your values, and that's how the coaches and the athletic departments have these local sponsorship deals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I feel like people were. We're operating on old news in terms of, like you pointed out, kid having $27,000 to spend at his discretion, tax-free, you know, for a year to play in college. Like, we've gotten to this point to which, like, look, we're good. Enough is, in fact, enough. And part of being in college is you got to manage whatever finances you have. You have to learn, and you're never going to starve because now you have unlimited meals and things like that. What's your take on the name and likeness?
Well, obviously governors are signing it left and right, so it's going to have to be something that's going to be addressed before 2023. But, personally, like, I think the perfect example is, like, you know, Zion Williams is a good example. So how about this? I remember it was like last June or something, like last May or June, I had a couple apparel companies reach out for quotes for Zion, because Zion had an offer from an apparel company for about $40 million on the table, right? So they're going to say, take this money and just work out with the cones, and you go to the draft, and then, you know, we'll see what happens from there. So he's going to get $40 million to sign with an apparel company. And so he wanted to buy him an insurance policy. And so I remember talking to John Gavani, who I talked to a lot about, you know, players and different things. And we were like, well, if he doesn't play this year, he's not going to prove himself. John was kind of like, and, you know, I don't want to quote John or speak for him, but he was like, well, that if he does that, he's going to walk, you know, he'll probably fall to like the 12 to 20 range, because we don't know who he is. I mean, he can dunk on these small kids in South Carolina, but like, can he play, you know? And so you got $40 million from an apparel company. You're probably a 12 to 20 pick. Well, he made the right decision and went to college to play for Duke, which is probably one of the best three platforms in college to be on. So had a great year, player of the year, has a good run in the tournament. And then what's he do? He signs a near $100 million deal with Jordan Brand. He's the number one pick in the draft, signing for – it's going to be $40 million over 4 years. And to look at it, he tripled his market value by going to college and having 1 year there.
And he's the 1% where the rest of the kids have don't even have those offers. You know what I mean? It's like,
correct.
I feel like you run the risk of destroying the entire system for a guy like Zion, and a guy like Zion ends up benefiting from every moment that he plays in college. Perfectly
correct. And I'm going to add to this one more thing too. And you know this as a former student athlete. There's sports we call non-revenues, track and field, you know, all these different sports that, you know, wrestling, what have you. Well, Oklahoma State makes money in wrestling, but they don't, you know, generate any income.
Right.
All those sports are going to go away if they completely change the model and it's a full pay-for-play system.
Correct.
And that really bothers me, because I had so many friends in college, and I know about stories of people in horrible economic backgrounds and systems where they have – their only chance to get out of what situation they're in is to get a scholarship, playing a sport, to go to a school, to get a degree, to better their life, and move on into the workforce. And that vehicle is playing a non-revenue sport at whatever school. That's going to go away. And that's what really makes me sad, because there's so many kids out there that I don't care what sport it is, golf or track and field, whatever, that those opportunities are going to be gone, because all the money is going to be going to the players that people say by rights earn it, because people are turning on the TV to see them. But they're turning on TV to see them because they're playing at Duke or Kansas, UCLA or Arizona, whatever.
Right.
Nobody watches D-League games. Like, I play the D-League. It's a wasteland of broken dreams. It's a better players.
Yes.
But it's worse basketball.
Yes.
And it's like, you know, I think there needs to be some kind of common ground where they are compensated something. We got to figure that out. But it can't just be you can market yourself, because then all the big schools are going to have, you know, I'm going to get $1 million from Longo Toyota to play basketball at UCLA. It's just, that's just what's going to happen. And so you can't regulate it. So they got to just find out something that all parties can coexist. And this beautiful thing of college basketball and college athletics isn't just wiped away or changed or, you know, unrecognizable after 2023. That's just my humble opinion.
Hey, man, I'm really happy that all the stuff that you went through as a player, as a human being, now you're a dad, a husband, and you're making mm-hmm. life. And glad to call you friend. I appreciate you joining us. We got to do this again. We got to do the Rome. At some point, we have to do the Rome discussion. We'll do some hoops discussion as well. But
for sure,
with time as the essence. Thanks for joining us.
Of course. Appreciate it, Doug. Thank you.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Doug Gottlieb Show weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that. Great conversation. We've been longtime kind of friends. Longtime friends. And we live close to each other. We'll do it again. Maybe we'll talk some ball after a big Kansas game or something like that. You can listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show every day, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app. Or you can download that podcast if you'd like. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Don't forget to download, subscribe, rate, tell a friend, tweet it out, whatever. Next week, I think what we'll do is we'll probably have a special guest and preview the NBA, because the season gets underway on Thursday, but we'll preview kind of the whole league, some trends, some things to look at, and so on and so forth. In the meantime, thanks for listening. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.